From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The bankruptcy bill will make it more difficult for people to get out of debt, but leaves in place loopholes for millionaires and corporations. Some Democrats joined Republicans in voting for the bill after Republicans voted down several dozen amendments that would have made the bill less punitive.
The bill to overhaul the nation's bankruptcy laws has passed the House and wins final congressional approval. We'll speak with a member of DebtSlavery.org and with Congressmember Jim McDermott. And today is April 15th, Tax Day. While millions of Americans scramble to file their taxes, some are refusing to pay. We'll take a look at war tax resistance. And Chicano political and civil rights activist Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez has died. We'll speak with his friend and columnist Roberto Rodriguez.
For all the years that I know or can remember or think about Corky is that I think the phrase, the fifth of la raza, probably would most fit him. You know, some of us think of Dolores Huerta or Cesar Chavez as the heart or the brain, but I think Corky was the fifth.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Three roadside bombs exploded in Baghdad today, killing at least one civilian and wounding eight others. One of the bombs went off near a U.S. convoy. At least five civilians were injured in the blast. A damaged Humvee could be seen in the area, which was sealed off by U.S. forces. Another device exploded in an eastern neighborhood where U.S. forces were also on patrol, killing one civilian and wounding three others. This, according to a police official. The latest attacks came a day after twin car bombs killed at least 15 people in Baghdad, the highest death toll from an explosion in Iraq for more than a month. Four more people were charged Thursday in the so-called UN oil for food scandal, among them a Texas oil executive and a South Korean businessman who was at the center of a 1970s corruption case involving Congress. The indictment also suggests money allegedly skimmed from the oil program might have ended up in the hands of two UN officials. Their names were not released. One of the indictments charges Texas businessman David Chalmers, who's the sole shareholder of Bay Oil, and two oil traders with paying millions in secret kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's government to secure oil deals. The fourth person charged was Tongsun Park, a South Korean citizen and fugitive who allegedly accepted millions of dollars from the Iraqi government while he operated in the United States as an unregistered agent for Baghdad. In the 1970s, Park was at the center of what became known as the Koreagate scandal, in which he was accused of trying to buy influence in Congress. Now to the battle over President Bush's nominees. The Washington Post is reporting that in 2003, John Bolton, Bush's nominee for U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, ordered a young official working closely with then-Secretary of State Colin Powell removed from duties in the State Department's Non-Proliferation Bureau in what U.S. officials described as a third attempt by Bolton to purge career officials he perceived as impeding his policy goals. The officials told the Post that Rexon Rue, an expert on non-proliferation issues in the Middle East, was transferred to another bureau after he failed to produce a document requested by Bolton's chief of staff. Bolton reportedly accused Ryu of concealing the information and of insubordination. One of the officials recalled Bolton saying he had a file on Ryu and did not want him to work on issues he was involved in. Ryu's former boss said that he was a brilliant and dedicated civil servant and that the allegations were found to be baseless. Democrats blocked a vote on Bolton this week, pushing it to next week. They're hoping that new information may persuade Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee to vote against the nomination. Republicans have a 10-8 majority on the committee. Meanwhile, the Senate Intelligence Committee has put the man who coordinated the bloody Contra War of the 1980s one step closer to being in charge of U.S. intelligence gathering. John Negroponte was approved yesterday in a closed-door vote, clearing the way for the full Senate to vote on his nomination as the country's first director of national intelligence. The committee also approved Lieutenant General Michael Hayden as deputy director. In other news from Capitol Hill, Congress passed legislation long sought by credit card issuers and championed by President Bush to force some consumers to pay part of their debts in bankruptcy. The bill represents the most comprehensive overhaul of U.S. bankruptcy laws in 25 years. The measure is Bush's second legislative victory this year in his drive to end what he calls frivolous court cases that sap economic growth. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted yesterday to send one of President Bush's controversial judicial nominees to a vote in the full Senate. Thomas Griffiths would serve on second most powerful court in the country. Only four Democrats on the committee opposed his nomination. Griffiths had been criticized by Senator Patrick Leahy for not obtaining a law license in Utah 5 years ago and for practicing with an expired license in Washington, D.C. without telling his clients. As the Senate heads towards a showdown over the rules governing judicial confirmations, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has agreed to join a handful of prominent Christian conservatives in a telecast portraying Democrats as against people of faith for blocking President Bush's controversial nominees. The telecast is being organized by the Family Research Council. It's scheduled to originate at a Kentucky megachurch the evening of April 24th. Promotional materials call the day Justice Sunday and depict a young man holding a Bible in one hand and a gavel in the other. The flyer does not name participants, but under the heading "The Filibuster Against People of Faith," it reads, quote, "The filibuster was once abused to protect racial bias, and it is now being used against people of faith." Organizers say they hope to reach more than a million people by distributing the telecast to churches around the country over the internet and over Christian television and radio networks and stations. President Bush said on Thursday he does not send email, not even to his twin daughters, because he fears, quote, "my personal stuff would be made public." In a meeting with the American Society of Newspaper Editors, Bush volunteered his aversion to email during a discussion on whether his administration is sufficiently responsive to requests made under the Freedom of Information Act. Bush said he avoids email because, quote, "everything is investigated in Washington, and as a result, quote, we're losing a lot of history, not just with me, but with other presidents as well." Today is tax day here in the United States, but not everyone is rushing to get their papers filed. In at least 50 communities across the country, demonstrations are planned at Internal Revenue Service offices, federal buildings, post offices, and other public places to protest the use of tax dollars to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Many of these events will include people giving their tax dollars to community groups instead of to the IRS. We'll have more on this later in the program. Former President Jimmy Carter harshly criticized the U.S. and other wealthy states for being stingy with foreign aid and said in rich countries, quote, "we really don't give a damn." In a speech to a human rights conference in Atlanta, Carter said increasing financial assistance was critical to battling malaria, AIDS, and other common diseases that disproportionately affect the poorest parts of the world. He especially criticized the United States for failing to follow other Western nations, which are increasing spending. A new study published this week in the British medical journal, The Lancet, charges some prisoners executed by lethal injection might be so inadequately sedated that they're awake enough to suffer agonizingly painful deaths. Researchers who studied blood samples of prisoners after executions found more than 40% contained levels of anesthesia so low that the prisoners might have been conscious during their executions. They also found that executioners in Virginia and Texas, homes to the nation's busiest death chambers, were not trained to administer anesthesia. The authors of the study called for a moratorium on lethal injections. The father of Nigerian human rights activist and playwright Ken Sarawiwa has passed away. Jim Bisenwiwa, a chief of the Ogoni people of southern Nigeria, died on April 1st at his home in Bane, Nigeria. He was believed to have been 101 years old. After his son was executed in 1995 for his resistance to the Shell Oil Corporation, Jim Wiwa became a symbol of the Ogoni struggle to defend their land and people from Nigeria's military regime and their corporate cronies. In 1998, Democracy Now!'s Jeremy Scahill and I were guests in Jim Wiwa's home in Ogoni land when we were doing the documentary Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. You can hear that at democracynow.org. And finally, one of this country's leading Chicano activists has died. Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez passed away Tuesday in Denver. He was an iconic leader in the movement for justice and equality for Mexican Americans in the Southwest, and is credited with raising the nation's awareness of the plight of urban Chicanos. We'll have more on Corky Gonzalez in a moment. Son de Ama by Orchestra Baobab here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you out there. Well, the House overwhelmingly approved a major overhaul of the nation's bankruptcy laws Thursday in a move that will make it harder for Americans to rid themselves of debt by filing for bankruptcy. The measure cleared the House on a vote of 302 to 126. It passed the Senate last month by 74 to 25. The bill now goes to the White House, where it is expected to be signed into law. President Bush commended the vote in a statement. He said, quote, "These common sense reforms will make the system stronger and better so that more Americans, especially lower income Americans, have greater access to credit." The bankruptcy legislation has been a priority of the credit card and banking industries for a decade, and it is the first rewrite of the bankruptcy code in a quarter of a century.
A central feature of the bill imposes a new means test on Americans who file for bankruptcy protection to determine if people should enter compulsory repayment plans rather than have their assets liquidated to repay creditors. The bill would also impose significant new costs on those seeking bankruptcy protection and give lenders and businesses new legal tools for recovering debts. The core of the bill was written in 1997. The House passed versions of it 8 times, but it usually stalled in the Senate. When the bill did pass the Senate, then President Bill Clinton refused to sign it. This time around, House Republican leaders refused to consider amendments on the floor and voted down a Democratic attempt to return the bill to committee. The amendments would have forced lenders to keep fees in check, expand disclosure, and would have given extra protection to victims of identity theft. In an editorial, The Washington Post writes the bill's, quote, "staunchest proponents should be embarrassed that it was muscled through the House in this kind of Potemkin democracy way. This process, or more precisely, lack of process, is becoming routine." We're joined right now by Democratic Congressmember Jim McDermott of Washington. He voted against the bankruptcy bill. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C., heading for a flight to Seattle. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about exactly what this bill does?
Well, you and Juan made a wonderful synopsis of it. The real issue here is it's a payoff to the credit card companies. They have been pushing this bill since 1997, and the power of the financial industries is such that they finally managed to get this thing through. It really clobbers poor people because, first of all, many people are not going to be.
Are you there, Congressman McDermott? I think we have just lost Congressmember McDermott. Well, we're going to ask David Swanson, who is joining us from our Washington studio. David Swanson, a board member of the Progressive Democrats of America and coordinator of DebtSlavery.org, an organization that, it's really a coalition of organizations opposing the current bankruptcy bill. Can you pick up where Congressmember McDermott left off?
I can certainly try, and thanks for having me. The congressman spoke eloquently on this bill the day before its passage, and those remarks are on our website, debtslavery.org. You know, the corporate media has sort of presented two views on this. One is that the bill is addressing massive fraud, you know, a claim disproven by evidence from the Congressional Budget Office, the Government Accounting Office, the FDIC, the nonpartisan American Bankruptcy Institute, numerous academic studies. The truth of the matter is that bankruptcies are up because debt is up dramatically. And in fact, in relation to debt, bankruptcy filings are down. And debt is up in large part because of the neglected healthcare crisis. A well-done academic study found that about half of bankruptcy filings are the result of medical costs. Another 40% are due to job loss, divorce, or a death in the family. Most of the others are due to natural disaster or call up to fight in Iraq or identity theft or victim of a crime. At most, 3.6%, according to the American Bankruptcy Institute, involve anyone getting out of any payments that they could have made. So, and the claims from the other side, at most, are 10%. So they've redone an entire legal system, making it drastically harder on everybody, except millionaires and corporations, to address alleged fraud by 10%. So it's a bill that is a dream bill for the lending industry, for the auto lenders, for retailers who lend, for corporations who might go bankrupt. But there's not a redeeming feature in it for citizens.
Well, I think we have Congressman Jim McDermott back on the line with us. We lost him there for a minute. Welcome back, Congressman.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Whatever happened.
No problem. We'd like to ask you, in terms of this battle in the House, the Washington Post, as we mentioned, had an editorial talking especially about the way that this was rammed through without amendments. Could you talk a little bit about the battle in the House and what's happening now in the House with some of this legislation, especially favored by the administration?
Well, this was a perfect example of what the problem in the House is now. It is a railroad. When they decide in the Rules Committee or in the Speaker's office, they bring it out on the floor and ram it through. They don't want to have the amendment process. In other years, we've had as many as a dozen amendments which we could debate and try and change the bill. This year, they said, well, we've debated it for the last 6 years. We don't need any amendments. Let's pass it. And it's, you know, you've got new members in the House. You've got a whole change in the economics of the country in the last since 1997, and yet they don't want to have any debate on the bill. They want to run it right through. That's typical of their. They'll do the same thing next week on the energy bill. They'll run that through the Congress, giving away $7 billion to the oil industry without very much debate. And it's really the ending of democracy, because democracy requires debate and various opinions have to be expressed.
And in terms of the bill itself, obviously the financial industry has been claiming that it's been suffering from increased bankruptcies, but yet every day that I open up my mailbox, I find credit card companies trying to convince me to take out more cards, or if I have a card, to take out more debt. So they're constantly marketing debt to the American people. And so how badly are they doing?
They're not doing nearly as badly. They just want to squeeze the last drop of blood out of a turnip. The day's Washington Post has a story on the front page about a woman who had $65,000 in debt. She discharged it in a bankruptcy suit, and the next day she got a credit card because that $65,000 was taken off, so it shows nothing, and she got these things sent through the mail to her because the credit card companies look and they say, oh, look, here's a good lady. She's got no problems, no debts, and they send her a credit card. There is simply no restriction whatsoever on their marketing of those cards, and unfortunately, people get into using them, and then something like an illness comes along and wipes them out, or a divorce or something. Most of these are filed because of real family disasters.
Looking at the amendments that were voted down, including closing off the trust loophole for millionaires, limiting the homestead exemption, creating a minimum homestead exemption to save the homes of the elderly, protecting employees and retirees from corporate practices that deprive them of their earnings and retirement savings when a business files for bankruptcy, discouraging predatory lending practices, exempting debtors from means testing if their financial problems were caused by identity theft, limiting the amount of interest that can be charged on any extension of credit to 30%. And it goes on from there, providing protection for medical debt homeowners. Who is in charge of pushing this through? How much money are they getting from the industries that benefit? Let's put that question to David Swanson of DebtSlavery.org.
Since 1989, the credit card companies have given over $43 million in campaign contributions. But that's not the entire story, in that the auto loan companies and retailers and, in many cases, credit unions and numerous other corporations, as well as the Chamber of Commerce, have lobbied intensely for this bill over a period of years. And that lobbying has had a strong effect. You know, the credit card industry is turning the government with this law into its collection agency at a public cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. So this law is not about individual responsibility, but it's clearly also not about responsibility for the credit card industry, which makes massive profits, $30 billion last year, off of the high rates it charges for those who are risky borrowers, supposedly. But now it wants the government to step in and guarantee that even for those who default, every last dime is going to be squeezed out of people at public expense.
David Swanson, in terms of those who voted for the bill, there was a significant number of Democrats who voted for the bill. Were there any also Republicans who broke ranks and decided to oppose this bill?
There were not. Every single Republican in both houses voted, and every single one voted for the bill. In the Senate, 18 Democrats and one independent voted for the bill. One Democrat did not vote. In the House, 73 Democrats, which is down from 90 last time around, voted for the bill. So the rhino, the Republican in name only, has really gone extinct here. The Republicans have closed ranks, but the dino, the Democrat in name only, is growing and is gaining attention. And Progressive Democrats of America is going to go after these Democrats, and Move On is going to be running ads in these Democrats' districts against them for having backed this bill.
Congressmember McDermott, I know you have to get on that plane back to your district in Seattle, but I wanted to just ask you a quick question on another issue, but on Capitol Hill. Congressional Republicans killed the Democrats' latest attempt to rewrite ethics rules in a 218-195 vote along party lines, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi swiftly issuing a statement accusing Republicans of showing allegiance to the ethics standards of Tom DeLay. Only two Republicans dissented. The vote came a day after a few lawmakers expressed concern at a closed-door meeting over the party's handling of the ethics issue. Several officials said that Congressmember Dan Lundgren of California cautioned fellow Republicans about using power arrogantly, invoking the example of former House Speaker Jim Wright and the Democratic majority he once led. Can you talk about what's happening with the Ethics Committee and this vote?
Well, basically, the Ethics Committee is dead in the House. They put in amendments to the rules which would make it absolutely impossible to carry on an investigation against anybody, because you need not only the committee is balanced 5-5. You need 6 votes. So that means one person from the other side has to come across and affirmatively say we should investigate Tom DeLay or we should investigate anybody. And if you can't get somebody from the other party to do that, it dies after 45 days. So it's essentially a graveyard. They've made the Ethics Committee a graveyard for any complaints against people that have power in the House. And they've also given the ability to have lawyers coordinate testimony. They've done all kinds of things
to make it very difficult to look at the problems. If this was what was going on in 1989 against Jim Wright, the screams from the Republican side would be unbelievable about the arrogance. And this guy has carried it to such a degree that he actually got them to vote last year that you could serve even if you'd been indicted. I mean, there is absolutely nothing that they won't do to protect Tom DeLay, but I think he's a dead man walking. I think this is going to rebound against him. I've been here a long time. I've seen a lot. I served on the Ethics Committee for 6 years. I know what happens, and I think in spite of their efforts, they ought to be listening to Dan Lundgren or some of the more rational voices in their caucus and make a decision that they're going to do what the Republicans did to Gingrich. I mean, they had to let Gingrich go out there and be put through the process.
There was an attempted coup against Gingrich before he ultimately left.
Exactly. And he, you know, he created the problem for himself, and nobody forced him to do any of that stuff. And it became evident. I mean, Porter Gloss was the chairman of the investigating subcommittee, and it wasn't that Porter didn't want to protect Gingrich, but there was a point at which it was simply not possible, and Porter's commitment to the House and the institution was such that he had to do the job of bringing out a $300,000 fine and a reprimand and so forth. That has got to go on here. That process has to go on. Maybe Mr. DeLay hasn't done anything. I don't know. But the process has to work. Because if the process doesn't work, the American people say they're so corrupt we can't trust them for anything.
Well, Congressman McDermott, we'll let you go. I'm sure that your fellow passengers will be happy about that as they're just about to close the doors there. Congressman McDermott heading back to Seattle, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. We're going to ask David Swanson to stay on the line so we can go to break and ask you just another question about the issue of bankruptcy and the legislation that was just passed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you and 19 for me. Cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man. Rough. Now dig this. Should 5% appear too small? Just be thankful. I don't take it all. Tax man is something else, isn't it? Cause I'm the tax man. Yes, I'm the tax man. Now dig this.
Taxman by Junior Parker here on Democracy Now! On this tax day, and in a minute we're going to talk about that. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, but we're still on the line with David Swanson, David Swanson of DebtSlavery.org in Washington, D.C. Juan?
David, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the bill that now has passed and is expected to be signed by the president, for the average American, what will change in terms of what they can expect if they've happened to fall behind on the money that they owe to a credit card company?
Well, many, many Americans will be unable to file under Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which is the form of bankruptcy that allows you to get out of some of the debts you're unable to repay. And under the current system, a judge makes that decision and decides it based on your actual income and expenses. Under this new regime, if you are under the median income in your state, and it will be your responsibility and legal cost to prove that you are, you will be required to go to a loan counseling agency, many of which are quite predatory in themselves, and they will be the gatekeepers. And whether you file under Chapter 7 or Chapter 13, which many more people will be forced into, which requires a long-term payment plan, it will be much, much harder for you. You will have, there will be more assets that you cannot keep. There will be more payments that you have to make. Child support payments will go first to credit card companies in many cases rather than to children. I mean, it's absolutely extreme, and there's a long laundry list of changes, and they are all to the disadvantage of consumers. So I would encourage people to go to debtslavery.org, see which way your Congress member voted, and call them. It's as important now to thank them or blame them as it was beforehand.
Isn't this a done deal?
It is a done deal, but there's an election next year, and we want to remember who voted which way, and we want to keep up the pressure and the media attention as this goes into effect 6 months from now. We also want to fight the energy bill and the predatory lending bill and the Central American Free Trade Agreement. This is part of an agenda that's an attack of class warfare on working Americans, and we want to make some noise about that and hold accountable those who voted with the credit card companies on a bill without a single redeeming feature for ordinary Americans.
David Swanson, we want to thank you for joining us. Again, that website, debtslavery.org, and you can go to our website where we link to our guest websites, and that's democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting on over 330 radio and television stations around the country, on public access TV stations, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9415, Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we video and audio stream at democracynow.org, and our closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And I look forward to seeing listeners of KUNM this weekend and KSFR as well in Albuquerque and Santa Fe on Saturday. On Sunday, we'll be in Las Vegas. Juan, today is the day.
Yes, today is April 15th, tax day. While millions of Americans are scrambling to file their income taxes on time, others are taking a different route. In at least 50 communities across the country, demonstrations will be held at Internal Revenue Service offices, federal buildings, post offices, and other public places to protest the use of tax dollars to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some are making their protests stronger by refusing to pay some or all of their federal taxes that help pay for the war.
Joining us now in our Firehouse studio in New York is Ruth Benn. She's co-author of the book War Tax Resistance and the coordinator of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, a coalition of local, regional, and national groups founded more than 20 years ago to provide information and support to people who are conscientious objectors to paying taxes for war. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Talk about what war tax resistance is.
Well, war tax resistance is done by people who really don't want their tax money to go for anyone to fight in war, for, you know, people to be victims of war, for all the weapons of war. So myself, I'm a longtime war tax resistor. It's been 20 years or so now. So it's not just necessarily focused on the current war, although that is certainly inspiring more people to think about resisting now. And it's got a whole variety of ways, I guess, that people go about resisting. Some of us refuse to pay all of our income taxes, all federal income taxes. Some people refuse to pay a small portion of that, a symbolic amount. Some people just refuse to pay the federal excise tax on the telephone. That's a federal tax that also pays into the general fund, the same place that income taxes go. And some people file and tell the government exactly what they're doing, like I do. I actually do try to get my form in on April 15th and have to rush home and do that today. And I fill it out normally, and the amount that is owed, I send a letter saying why I'm refusing to pay it. Other people choose choose not to file and not be involved with the government at all because of their protest of where the money goes.
And how has the government responded in the past to your tax resistance or to those of others?
Well, it varies a great deal. For myself, I get a lot of letters. Maybe I think once in 89 or 90, they took some money from a bank account, and bank account seizures and salary levies are, I guess, the most common way that they try to collect from people who refuse to pay these days. In the past, they have gone after property, houses and cars, and people hear those stories, and that helps build up the fear of the IRS and makes people afraid to make this kind of protest. But the government hasn't been doing that so much lately. It's very labor-intensive, of course, to do that kind of seizure for them. It's been probably more than 10 years since a war tax resister faced a property seizure. So they send a lot of letters. That's the number one route of collection for the IRS. That's the main thing that they do to scare people. And they publicize what they can do. And, of course, it's the fear that is really what keeps people complying with this system. At the same time, their money is paying for a lot of death and destruction around the world and not taking care of people here and in other places. So.
Can you talk about the history of war tax resistance? How did it start? And then the differences when you're paying or not paying the IRS or paying or not paying a portion of your phone bill?
Well, I'm sure that as with people who refuse to fight in war and conscientious objection to military service, it's been around as long as there's been any tax somewhere in the world, that there's somebody who said, you know, I'm not going to do that and I'm not going to pay for it either. In the U.S., the first instance was, I think, the 1600s, Algonquin Indians who refused to pay for a fort that the Dutch were building to be used against the Indians, the Native Americans. And but the current war tax resistance movement is started in World War II in particular, the modern war tax resistance movement, we call it, during World War II, when the income tax was instituted and withholding, taking money from people's paychecks up front, I suppose you could say. So ever since World War II, it's been a fairly consistent and active movement. A lot of connection with the Quakers and the Peace Churches, the Brethren and the Mennonite. But as with refusal to fight in wars, it crosses boundaries. People who conscientiously refuse for other reasons. So your question about income tax.
The different forms of the resistance, income tax, and then this whole issue of the phone bill. Mm-hmm. What portion of it?
Well, I'll start with the telephone tax, which actually was first instituted in the late 1800s, the Spanish-American War. And telephones at that time were a luxury, so it was a luxury tax on the phone specifically to pay for that war. And then the government took it off. World War II, they needed money again, so they put the tax on again, took it off, or World War I, sorry, took it off after World War I. World War II put it on again, and it's pretty much been steady since then. During the Vietnam War, the telephone tax was as high as 10%. I think it was Wilbur Mills who said the tax is going to this level specifically to pay for the Vietnam War. It's only the Vietnam War that we're raising it to 10%. And after that, after Vietnam War, it was supposed to be removed, but instead the government, it's a tax that people don't notice, so it's an easy one for them to keep on. And currently it's at 3%, and it's a permanent tax now. They had to renew it for a number of years, and then about 10 years ago they made it permanent. So that 3% on all phone bills, cell phone, everything except internet phone service, that 3% tax goes into the general fund, parceled out the same way that income taxes are. And then income tax resistance, people might choose to pay a symbolic amount, $1, which, you know, certainly in the current situation and considering what our tax dollars are doing and the consequences of paying taxes these days and seeing what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan around the world, refusing to pay $1 if you owe something and sending a letter and saying, this is why I'm making this protest, is an important statement. There are other people who refuse to pay about 30%, which is about the current military spending. Other people who choose to refuse everything. And so it's really variable. It's a creative form of resistance.
I was going to ask that because obviously the federal taxes go to more than just paying for the military or for war, and those who might be deciding to not pay any federal taxes are in effect also saying, I don't want to have to pay anything for any of the government services, as poor as some of them are, that we're getting. So so you're saying there are those who just specifically say, well, this is the percentage of the budget that goes to military spending or war, and that's what I'm not paying.
Right. There are a number of people who do that. Some choose 30%. We use the war a lot of war tax resistors use the War Resisters League pie chart, which is on the War Resisters League website at warresistors.org, which shows about 50% going to past and current military. Some people just focus on the 30% current military. I think the Iraq spending now is about 3% of the federal budget, another percentage that people can look at and refuse to pay. But I think those of us who refuse to pay 100% of federal income taxes also try to redirect that money to other programs. And for myself, I file state and local taxes, and I do pay state and local taxes. I pay into Social Security. But it's that the federal portion that I'm really so furious about. And so that money I redirect, and I give it to food banks or housing programs or aid to victims of war and other groups. And a lot of war tax resistors do that, too.
What if everyone did this? People who are opposed to abortion, for example, people who just don't like certain aspects of the government, everyone sort of picks and chooses what they don't support.
Well, of course, I support people who stand up for their beliefs. Abortion now is a teensy tiny percentage of the budget, if it's even in there anymore, because anti-abortion people have been quite successful at removing that from federal spending. So, but when we're looking at war spending, we are looking at 50% of the budget, and a bloated military spending tied in with all these corporations, Bechtel, Lockheed Martin, Halliburton, all of them who are profiting from this war, billions and billions of dollars, which could be used better. So I do think those of us who are against war need to stand up and resist and take a stand.
What are people doing today?
All kinds of different things around the country. I think the great thing about Tax Day and the peace movement in general and peace and justice movement is that it's very grassroots oriented. People get out, download a flyer from a website, go out to your post office or IRS federal building, and hand out information about where tax dollars are going. I think the American public really doesn't realize what a huge percentage it is, or even think about that $5 billion a month that's paying for the current wars now. So, it's coast to coast, really. There are people up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, who have, they're coming out in masks of Bush, Rumsfeld, Condi, and the whole gang there, with a big sign saying, "We found the WMDs, they're in the president's budget." There are people in Portland, Oregon, who are going to be hanging signs from bridges there during rush hour this morning. Tulsa, Oklahoma has a War Breaks the Budget Tax Day protest at the post office there, I think. There's lots of information. There's a whole list of actions on the National War Tax Resistance website, which is NWTRCC.org.
Last question on the phone bill, and that is, if you don't pay this tax, the phone tax, isn't your phone going to cut off eventually because you haven't paid your bill?
Well, when the excise tax that's imposed, it's the burden is on the IRS to collect that money. So the phone companies, although a lot of them don't understand this, are supposed to, they should credit the tax on a person's bill, assuming you should send a note saying why you're refusing to pay that tax. And the phone company is supposed to credit it and report that amount to the IRS. So the bill should come to you from the IRS, and the phone company should not cut off the service on the phone.
I know that groups like Catholic Worker have refused to pay that tax for years, and they do have a phone. Ruth Benn, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-author of the book War Tax Resistance. And the website is
NWTRCC.org, or if you search on war taxes, it'll come right up at the top of the list.
And, of course, our website, democracynow.org, will have that information. When we come back, we remember Corky Gonzalez. Stay with us. Day by Jaga Jagast here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Chicano political and civil rights activist Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez has died. He died on Tuesday at home in Denver, Colorado. He was 76. Gonzalez was an iconic leader in the movement for justice and equality for Mexican Americans in the Southwest. He's credited with raising the nation's awareness of the plight of urban Chicanos. In the mid-1960s, he founded an urban civil rights and cultural movement called the Crusade for Justice, which advocated Chicano nationalism. During the late 60s and early 70s, he organized walkouts, demonstrations against police brutality, and marches against the Vietnam War.
In 1968, Gonzalez led a Chicano contingent to the Poor People's March on Washington, D.C., and issued a Plan of the Barrio, which demanded better housing, education, and restitution of Pueblo lands. Gonzalez was also an organizer of the annual Chicano Youth Liberation Conference, which sought to create unity among Chicano youth. He also advocated for increased political representation for Chicanos. In 1972, he was the keynote speaker at the newly formed La Raza Unida Party National Convention in El Paso, Texas. The party fielded political candidates to run for office in the state. But perhaps Gonzalez is best known for his poem, I Am Joaquin, Yo Soy Joaquin. He wrote the epic poem in 1965, and it is one of the most important literary works to emerge from the Chicano movement. In the poem, he tells of the historic struggles faced by Mexican Americans in the United States.
Joining us on the phone right now from Minnesota to talk about the life and legacy of Corky Gonzalez is writer and columnist Roberto Rodriguez. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Yes, good morning, Amy and Juan.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about your friend, colleague, Corky Gonzalez?
Yeah. Well, like any mythic hero, it's kind of hard initially because we're still in the shock and the mourning. I don't think he's buried until Sunday. So, I mean, keeping that in mind, you know, as I think about Corky, you know, it's, I guess there's words that swirl around the I am Joaquin. I think for a lot of us, we look at it probably as a manifesto, you know, because, I mean, you could also look at it as a poem or something literary, but at the same time, it was also a manifesto, but not like political only, but almost the spiritual manifesto, because I think that poem that Juan mentioned, you know, it talked about how, you know, all of us, we all used to call each other different names, like Mexicano, Latino, Chicano, all these different names, and everybody be fighting about it, you know, and I think that poem was an attempt to unify a people. Now, you know, the unity maybe was more, an illusion, perhaps. But at another level, you know, I think people felt unified and felt good about that poem. It was no longer, you know, in the streets there was like people call each other wetbacks and mojados and pochos. You know, that was the derisiveness. And this was the opposite. You know, it was an attempt to say, you know, we're one people. And there's another thing that I should mention too about who he was, because I think civil rights would probably not be sufficient in terms of a leader. I think Juan, of course, would know this firsthand. You know, I think it was the language of liberation. And so when people spoke of movement in those days, you know, that we were talking about movements around the world, you know, liberation movements. And he was critical in principle in that idea of, in this instance, Aztlan, you know, something to liberate. You know, through the years, of course, that has become something different, more, of course, civil rights or human rights. But at the time, it was like, you know, hey, you know, why are we being chased out of our ancestral homes? That was the language of the time.
And could you talk a little bit about the Crusade for Justice and its impact on Chicano youth and youth all around the country at that time, and then the rise of Raza Unida and Corky's role in that?
Sure. I think, you know, the Crusade for Justice is, when I was thinking about it, I was saying, you know, I think I had talked earlier about, like, Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, you know, they represented something very special for us as a people, you know, and we could probably see them as perhaps the heart, you know. He was the fist, you know, that is the Crusade for Justice stood for defiance, resistance. And that, so, in other words, rather than get into specificities, you know, of the role, the specific role of the crusade, I think in a bigger sense we can look at it like that's what the crusade was. That's what it meant to us as a people, that we were no longer going to, you know, sit or stand or kneel with our heads bowed and, you know, si patron or si señor. You know, I think the crusade gave us that, you know, that impetus, that you know, again, that hey, we're not going to take it, and I think that's what I think we can learn or remember the crusade for. You know, the crusade evolved later into Escuela Tlatelolco. You know, but the earlier era that you're referring to also is the Raza Unida Party. You know, again, very turbulent era, but again, it was also in that context of things, liberatory things, ideas. And I think the Raza Unida Party at that time meant a breaking from the democratic stranglehold of, you know, the Republicans that had wanted nothing to do with us, and the Democrats took us for granted. And so La Raza Unida Party was supposed to be that alternative. Now, as you well know, I mean, you had these intelligence operations that were heavy duty, you know, fighting, pitting peoples against each other, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it effectively destroyed not just the Raza Unida Party, but many movements throughout the world, in this country in particular. So, but that's why, again, we can look at his biography and his obituary and see all the accomplishments and controversies and all these things. But in the end, I think he will be seen as a mythic hero, you know, somebody who, you know, stood up and... You know, when I say fist, I mean, in a sense, it's literal. You know, he was a boxer. And I think it's the idea was like, yes, you know, we can fight back.
What had he been doing in his later years, clearly after the high tide of the movement in the 70s began to ebb? What was he involved in his later years?
Well, one thing that's really important to note is that... at that time and a little later, also critical work was the relations between the Crusade and Chicano movement with the American Indian movement. You know, that's something that many people don't know. You know, and you well know, of course, the relations between Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, Chicanos, and other peoples. But one thing that people didn't know, perhaps, is the relationship between Chicanos and AIM, which I think at the time the FBI considered that the greatest threat to national security, you know, the whole idea that Chicanos might one day see themselves as being native. And one thing, you know, his history has got is too long to detail, except that something that many people should know, perhaps, because in the last, I would say, God, 15 years or so, you know, he had a heart attack and he crashed and he was never the same. You know, I remember my wife and I, you know, Patricia, you know, we went to Tlatelolco, you know, presented, and we saw him and met him again. And he was no longer the same person from an earlier era. And so what I want to mention this is because this generation probably will only remember, you know, a señor, you know, this great man who, you know, barely was able to move around, so to speak, you know, and not know the impact he had, you know, in the 50s as a boxer, you know, as a leader, you know, 60s, 70s. He was an incredible man. And in the last 15 years, he was slowed, so to speak, by those injuries. But, I mean, so powerful was his effect from that early era that, I mean, he, I think, will live on always as, you know, Cesar Chavez will live on. And you know, the people remain alive, because their ideas will remain alive.
We're talking to Roberto Rodriguez. What about Corky Gonzalez suing the Rocky Mountain News in February of 1974, a $30 million libel suit, because of what he felt was their inaccurate representation of people in Crusade?
Yeah. Well, I could only characterize that as part of the same era where, and I'm almost hesitating to laugh because you probably know this full well, to this day, I mean, that is the principal battle of not simply Chicano movements, but people of color as well, indigenous movements, every single day we are mischaracterized, we are censored, you know, and on a good day, you know, we're misrepresented. And that was part of that era. You know, part of the same era, of course, is the whole struggle with Coors. You know, that was, again, this is another generation, but the struggle with media is, God, it's really tragic, maybe tragicomic, but it's never ending. It's not limited. That's why when people look at Corky, they're not looking at Corky in Denver or Corky in the Crusade, but this is emblematic of the entire nation. I mean, you know, as, you know, your colleagues of ours, you know, whenever we go anywhere, that's probably the number one complaint, that the media is misrepresenting us. They're forcing an identity upon us. They're commercializing us. You know, in his case, of course, you were dealing with other matters and other factors. You know, obviously, you know, that all the intelligence stuff. God, I mean, I don't know. It's almost like I'm looking into a mirror into the future. You know, now we have the government buying media, you know, manufacturing stories, you know, so I don't know, it's kind of weird, you know, that media always seems to be the spear, you know, of anti-progressive movements, you know, anti-indigenous, anti-Chicano, Puerto Rican, you know, all these movements, the media is always there at the forefront. You know, I don't know if whatever happened to the lawsuit, if he won, he may have. I remember Bert Corona in L.A. won a lawsuit. There was always lawsuits everywhere, and there'd probably be too many, you know, if people really... I don't know. I think people sometimes get cynical about the media and just give up on it.
Well, Roberto Rodriguez, we want to thank you very much for being with us as we remember Corky Gonzalez, who died at his home in Denver, Colorado, this week. Thank you. And that wraps up our coverage. Monday, Juan will be joined by Elena Poniatowska, a leading Mexican journalist.
Yes, and we'll look at some of the enormous changes occurring in Mexico right now, and the citizen uprising over the government's attempt to indict one of the leading presidential candidates.
Also, look at the killing of Mexican journalists, yes, especially covering the drug war and issues along the border. And that's going to be on Monday here on Democracy Now! Today, the Unamed the Media Tour heads to Baltimore for the National Federation of Community Broadcasters Conference at noon. And then at 3, we'll be at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health tonight at the Unity United Methodist Church at 7:30 p.m. in Baltimore. Tomorrow, Saturday, Albuquerque at noon at UNM, University of New Mexico Student Union Ballroom, as we celebrate KUNM. In the evening in Santa Fe, St. John's College Gym with the Nobel Peace Prize winner and East Timor's foreign minister, José Ramos Huerta, on Sunday. We'll be in Taos, New Mexico at Batan Hall, Civic Plaza Drive, and on Sunday night at 7 p.m., the Reading Room in Las Vegas. You can get more information at our website at democracynow.org. And that does it for today's broadcast. The show is produced by a remarkable team of people: Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. Special thanks to Uri Gallet, our director, our technical director, Angela Alston, Chris Zucker, and the whole team that makes this broadcast possible. Also thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Karen Renucci, Jenny Filippazzo. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.